Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And we've got Paul Venable with us. And so welcome back, Paul.
Hey, thanks, G.R. How are you?
You know, I'm doing better than most, not as good as some, and I'm ready to kind of dive into these reports. And as a matter of fact, one of the things I kind of want to add to this is the fact that it just came to me, so I sent it to you. There is a letter that James Madison actually sent off to John G. Jackson. When these men, because I've mentioned this before, and I've never placed this letter into the queue, but there were a bunch of men in 1820, 1821 that started really questioning what the federal government was doing. And okay. So they formally requested that James Madison release his notes that he took during the Constitutional Convention, because these men really wanted to understand the Constitution, you know, okay. And they just wanted to have better insights of how these men debated and discussed and placed context to the various lines in the Constitution. And so his response was very interesting, because he could have said a lot of things, and he kind of got into the personal side of the fact that I heard some background noise. It threw me off. So he gets into this, you know, how his plan was to posthumously release those notes as a financial assistance for Dolly, for his wife. He doesn't necessarily go into the details, but he just basically says that was a work that he wanted to do separately. He didn't want his notes on the convention to cloud the ratification and to cloud everybody's opinion. What was more important, and this is what he leads to, he says, it really didn't matter what we thought. This is one of the reasons why he suppressed that information. And as a matter of fact, I've ran into people that, you know, in California that, you know, knew the, and this is interesting, they had Madison's notes, because you can get Madison's notes on the convention at the Avalon site. And in other words, you could go out and buy his book, or you could just buy his notes, or not download his notes without really getting his book, because his book is hard to get in print and so forth. But nevertheless, this gentleman.
I've got his book and a download. So, yeah, I know what you mean.
And so this gentleman, basically, when I ran into this guy, and this was a radio, this is the guy that brought me onto the radio. And, you know, he was really, I don't want to say he was puffed up, but he was pretty proud of the fact that he really understood the Constitution, because he's read Madison's notes. And then, you know, and I'm laughing, because what Madison says in this letter is, it doesn't really matter what we thought. You know, that does not explain the Constitution. The only thing that matters is how the Constitution was explained to the states at the time of ratification. So we're going to go through this letter so that everybody really understands how important the ratification debates really are, but more importantly, he clearly lays out this concept of contract law, that however it was stipulated, however it was defined, however the Federalists laid out the terms of each of the clauses, that is what really matters. And so we'll get into that before we get into his notes on nullification. And so And here's the interesting thing, you know, because I know I rail on, you know, organizations, you know, all the time, like the John Birch Society. And I can go on and on and on about that. But the interesting thing is, some of these documents have actually come from my friends in the John Birch Society. As a matter of fact, both the letter from John G. Jackson and the report on, as a matter of fact, all three of these documents have been, you know, handed to me from members of the John Birch Society. It's not whether they actually gave, you know, it was my first introduction. The John G. Jackson letter was the first introduction from a John Birch that I knew in California a long time ago. And the report on the Virginia resolutions and both the notes on nullification, as a matter of fact, you know the gentleman that actually cited, he didn't give them to me. I mean, I already had these things, but the guy that you taught the Constitution, who is prominent within the John Birch Society today, actually cited and he quoted, you know, and we'll get into that when we get to Madison's notes on the Constitution. And I'm scratching my head going, here people have actually had this in their hands and they're not walking away with the same thing. As a matter of fact, we already covered this. But in paragraph 9 of the report, this is a John Bircher that was a leader back in 2006. Mm-hmm. A prominent leader in the JBS basically put this out, and he really cited this one paragraph. And it was later on when I realized, hey, you know, this he's the guy that kind of introduced this to me, you know, mm-hmm. as a really prominent, how important this letter was or how important this report was. And I'm going, how come he didn't read the rest of this document? How come he didn't come up with this clarity on interposition and come up with Republic Review on his own? This guy was a pretty smart guy.
Right.
And well, I'm just, go ahead.
No, that's interesting. You know, I was just thinking about something. You were pretty strong on the John Birch Society last show. And I understand because apparently you shared with me, you know, some of the experiences you've had. Some of them been good, but some of them haven't been so good. And I guess the audience may not know that because we've got a lot of friends.
Yeah. You know,
I have a lot of friends in the John Birch Society. And you know, that organization still visits our events.
Sure.
So it might, you know, sometime we get a chance, it might not be a bad idea for you to just share, maybe at another time, some of the direct experiences you've had, because they surprised me.
Oh, yeah. So, you know what, when we have time and get and place context to it, because, you know, when you've been attacked, because actually, folks, I've actually been attacked. When I've done presentations, they've tried to do a smear job, and they really failed. It's almost like, you know, it was a well-orchestrated assassination, except what ended up happening was, you know, they failed. They didn't take me down, and everything that they used backfired on them because they thought they had the right stuff, and they didn't. And I'll get into that. Let's place that into context. Let me read this one part, because this we already read this, but like I said, how is it that you read this, but you didn't go further down and read what we're reading today? And he goes, this is Madison, this is paragraph 9. The observation just made is equally applicable to the solemn declaration of warm attachment to the Union and the solemn pledge to maintain it. Nor can any question arise among enlightened friends of the Union as to the duty of watching over and opposing every infraction of those principles which constitute its basis, and a faithful observance of which we can alone secure its existence and public happiness thereon depending. And I go, well, you know, that's a really powerful point of standing up and defending and, you know, and opposing every infraction on these principles of limited government. And how is it that they didn't go further in, you know, reading this, you know, the rest of this document to understand how Madison really starts spelling out very specifically? So since we're diving into the context, or I should say the content at this point, let's go ahead and have you start with where we left off, with paragraph 16, the other position involved in this branch of the resolution, namely that the states, you got that? Are you there?
Sorry, there was some background noise, and so I muted myself. Let me get there really quick.
All right.
So this is, we are on the report.
Paragraph 16 of the report, correct.
Okay, there we go. Okay. Now, it's not highlighted.
But we're reading the – well, so we started reading these because we never covered this last time. See, okay. When we came back after the Constitution, we read just the highlights out of the Virginia resolutions and the Kentucky resolutions, and then we read the entire Kentucky resolution of 99, and now – if you probably forgot, we're reading the entire thing of the report. So go ahead.
Okay, here we go. 16. The next position is that the General Assembly views the powers of the federal government, quote, as limited by the plain sense and intention of the instrument constituting the compact, end quote. And, quote, as no further valid than they are authorized by the grants therein enumerated, end quote. It does not seem possible that any just objection can lie against either of these clauses. The first amounts merely to a declaration that the compact ought to have the interpretation plainly intended by the parties to it. The other to a declaration that it ought to have the execution and effect intended by them. If the powers granted be valid, it is solely because they are granted. And if the granted powers are valid because granted, all other powers not granted must not be valid.
Okay, so he's clearly pointing out this delineation that the compact grants powers and that if it's not granted, it's not a power. And then he goes into 18, where he talks again about the resolution. He does a little citation here. Go ahead.
Okay. And it appears to your committee to be...
Oh, I'm sorry, sorry. 17.
Okay, yeah. You said 18.
I did say, yep.
Yeah, and I should have asked. All right, the resolution having taken this view of the federal compact proceeds to infer, quote, that in the case of deliberate, palpable, and dangerous exercise of other powers not granted by the said compact, the states who are parties thereto have the right and are in duty bound to interpose for arresting the progress of the evil and for maintaining within their respective limits, the authorities, rights, and liberties appertaining to them, end quote.
Okay, so he's kind of just reemphasizing what I read up in paragraph 9, as far as arresting, opposing these ideas or these attacks. And so 18 is really where I think the heavens kind of part, or where you can hear the trumpets, because this right here, folks, is this is where I scratch my head. How can you read everything above this and then read this and not understand what the heck Madison is talking about? This, to me, this is so fundamental. He lays it out that only the states have this authority. But let me let you read it. Let's go ahead and read that very first two lines, first two lines.
All right. It appears to your committee to be a plain principle, founded in common sense, illustrated by common practice, and essential to the nature of compacts.
Right there. Okay. So what is he saying?
He's saying that compacts work a certain way, and everybody understands how that works.
Right. So in other words, this is a legal convention that we call today contract law. Mm-hmm. He said, this is how it's done. We're not talking about something that is out of the ordinary that, all of a sudden the laws of physics or the laws of the law don't apply. Right. He's basically saying this all fits within the constraints, the convention of the law. The right. Process of how it happens. Go ahead. Keep going.
That where resort can be had to no tribunal superior to the authority of the parties, The parties themselves must be the rightful judges in the last resort, whether the bargain made has been pursued or violated. The Constitution of the United States was formed by the sanction of the states, given by each in its sovereign capacity.
There you go. Right there, he lays it out that the Constitution was given by the sovereign states in their sovereign capacity. So, in other words, the federal government is the byproduct of the states unifying on this thing we call this compact, the Constitution.
Right.
It is the Constitution that kind of binds them, but the Constitution doesn't legally bind them. It is not, it's a marriage that they willingly go into, but it is not a marriage that only God can break asunder like true marriage, if you understand what I'm saying.
Okay.
Right? I mean, you've heard that, right?
What God had joined, let no man put asunder.
Yeah. So when a man and a woman are joined, it really is to God, whether that, you know, that divorce or that breakup. But this is different. These are entities that are coming together, and they're creating this compact amongst each other. It's not that they're invoking this heavenly, I'll just call it ordinance, that we call marriage. So when we look at what Lincoln claimed in almost a likeness that this was a marriage that could only be broken by God. And that's not true.
Okay.
This is just a fundamental organizations coming together and making a commitment. So go ahead. Keep going.
Okay. It adds to the stability and dignity, as well as to the authority of the Constitution, that it rests on this legitimate and solid foundation. The states, then, being the parties to the constitutional compact and in their sovereignty, it follows of necessity that there can be no tribunal above their authority to decide in the last resort whether the compact made by them be violated, and consequently that as the parties to it, they must themselves decide in the last resort such questions as may be of significant magnitude to require their interposition.
There you go. So one little part that you kind of blipped out, probably because of some disturbance in the wire or something, because I didn't hear the sovereign. And at the very beginning, what you said is the states then being the parties to the constitutional compact, and in their sovereign capacity, it follows of necessity that there can be no tribunal over their authority. And the rest was audible, but it was the sovereign capacity wasn't audible. It just for some reason. But I just wanted to make sure the people heard that, because that sovereign capacity is actually pretty important.
Mm-hmm.
So, in other words, when we look at how the colonies were created, it was created by what sovereign? Or they were created by what sovereign? What was the sovereign capacity that created those charters?
Well, when the colonies were created, I believe it was probably by the king.
Yes,
right?
By the monarchs. Now, so I think that Virginia, I believe it was the queen that might have been, because they named Virginia after Queen Victoria, right?
I don't remember.
Anyway, so yeah, it was after the monarchs, because it was the monarchs that were granting this, and this was a part of the conquest or whatever you want to call it, the great expanse of Europe throughout and westernizing the world. But anywho, yes, the charters were done and made by the sovereign capacity of the king. Now we're looking at governments that were not necessarily truly instituted by the people, but they were instituted by the revolution of the people. So now we created these sovereign states, and now the states, having gone from the Articles of Association, the Articles of Confederation, now they have gone into this new compact called the Constitution, forming this brand new government. And so he goes on, and he kind of repeats himself here, but it's important. So I think he uses a different way of saying what he just said in paragraph 19.
This is 19, correct?
Yep.
Okay. It does not follow, however, because the states, as sovereign parties to their constitutional compact, must ultimately decide whether it has been violated, that such a decision ought to be interposed either, that such a decision ought to be interposed either in a hasty manner or on doubtful and inferior occasions. Do I understand that correctly?
Yeah. So what he's saying is, you don't want to use interposition because they're, you know, they slung an insult or over something really that's trite.
Oh, right.
You know, you want to make sure that you know, it's so sometimes the way they write, you'd think that he's actually saying that we don't want to interpose.
Well, it started with, it does not follow. Okay.
Right.
And as I was reading, I had forgotten this first clause here. So now it makes sense.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Even in the case of ordinary conventions between different nations, where by the strict rule of interpretation a breach of a part may be deemed a breach of the whole, every part being deemed a condition of every other part and of the whole, it is always laid down that the breach must be both willful and material to justify an application of the rule. But in the case of an intimate and constitutional union like that of the United States, it is evident that the interposition of the parties in their sovereign capacity can be called for by occasions only deeply and essentially affecting the vital principles of their political system.
There you go. So, so obviously when it really comes down to something significant that really puts the union, that really puts this compact in jeopardy, they really have to stand up. Now, just remember that Madison and Jefferson, one might think that these guys were, you know, Karens or, you know, drama queens because they were making a mountain out of a molehill here where they were, you know, hey, these Alien Sedition Acts. And they were actually using what some people would say hyperbole or hyperbolic, you know, points of going, hey, you know, this is going to destroy us.
Right.
And in a way, they were correct, because as long as we allowed the creature, the child, to get away with doing things they had no authority to do, then they will assume more and more, and it becomes this snowball effect that it just gets, they get more and more out of control.
Right.
And so what we're doing here is, go ahead and read paragraph 20.
Okay. The resolution has accordingly guarded against any misapprehension of its object by expressly requiring for such an interposition, quote, the case of a deliberate, palpable, and dangerous breach of the Constitution by the exercise of powers not granted by it, end quote, it must be a case not of a light and transient nature, but of a nature dangerous to the great purposes for which the Constitution was established. It must be the case, moreover, not obscure or doubtful in its construction, but plain and palpable. Lastly, it must be a case not resulting from a partial consideration or hasty determination, but a case stamped with a final consideration and deliberate adherence. It is not necessary, because the resolution does not require that the question should be discussed, how far the exercise of any particular power ungranted by the Constitution would justify the interposition of the parties to it. As cases might easily be stated which none would contend ought to fall within that description, cases, on the other hand, might with equal ease be stated so flagrant and so fatal as to unite every opinion in placing them within the description.
And I believe how he ended that was why they were going down this path of saying we have to interpose.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going into break right now. So when we come back, folks, we'll go back into paragraph 21 and continue on with Madison's report on the Virginia resolutions. And so you can kind of understand why they felt it was so important they had to go down this path. And so we'll be right back after this promo. Thank you so much.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty. Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so as we dive back into this, you know, what Paul just read was basically, you know, okay, so we don't want to go into this hastily, but when it comes down to the nature of, you know, these really dangerous and palpable things, that we cannot just sit idly by. And when it becomes flagrant, like he just says, so flagrant and so fatal, it should unite every opinion in placing them within the description. In other words, within this, you know, into this context, that we cannot let this go. I honestly see that had John Adams not got, had he, you know, said, you know what, because Paul, you know, when I look at what ended up happening in 1798 with the Alien and Sedition Acts, there should have been somebody else. Like John Adams, and you know what? This is wrong. This violates the First Amendment. That they shouldn't have actually crossed this line. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. In fact, it surprises me that this came out of John Adams.
And Hamilton was involved in this as well. I mean, so here's a real swipe that they made. James Madison should have actually gone to the same length. And I honestly believe that the reason why in 1792 that they created the Republican Party was in response to what Hamilton was doing, from the Assumption Act to the bank and creating the National Bank in 1792. You know, Madison was going, hey, we can't allow this. This is getting serious.
Right.
But, and those were implications. So when you look at what Hamilton was doing, he was pushing the government based on implied powers. Mm-hmm. Now, these were direct assaults. These were direct violations. But most everybody says, yeah, well, we should be able to get away with this. And they did, so to speak, if you know what I'm saying. In other words, there was, let's just call it a cabal.
So what we've wound up with in these days is the Hamiltonian doctrine. That's kind of what we're living, isn't it?
Oh, yes, absolutely. As a matter of fact, I kind of point that out in Why Counties Matter Most, in the fact that in the Enabling Act, when we start looking at how implied powers and how they started creeping their scope of control over admitting. So when you see the final draft, because I've made a significant change, I point out how John Marshall, being a protege of Madison and basically, you know, learning all of the sneaky diabolical tricks of how to slowly make implications, because a friend of mine, Douglas V. Gibbs, wrote a book, The Seven Greatest Lies that Impacted the Union or whatever. It's cited in this, where he talks about how John Marshall was one of the greatest culprits in moving, you know, away from the Constitution by redefining it. and making implications that the federal government possessed powers that they didn't possess, even though most people look at what he was doing as, you know, in response to the specific cases, he was correct. But when you read his opinions, those opinions became portals for, you know, this case law precedence as they started going down this path after all the framers had died. And as they started bringing case law in and creating this maze of legalese. Oh, well, he sets this precedence by saying this. And that's how they did it.
But, Jerry, shouldn't he have known better? We read his words in the ratification debate.
Yes, he did know better. And this is why there's a stark contrast between what Marshall was doing and what James Madison was doing. Maybe it would help if I go through those seven cases, but that would just take a long time. But there were seven hallmark cases where Marshall made assertions that were absolutely in contrast to what he stated during the ratification debates.
Sometime when you get a chance, we might not get to it on the show, but I wouldn't mind if you would share with me those cases. I mean, not right now.
Oh, sure. Actually, you know, I could, and it probably wouldn't take me that long to pull those cases up because as I do that, let me see here. Where are the citations? Right here. I've got them. And so I can pull up those cases for you, and they're right here. Marbury v. Madison, 1803.
Hang on. I want to write this down. Give me a sec.
Right.
I can type pretty fast.
And I place these in as a caveat because in Federalist Paper 81, Hamilton says, you know, I believe the phantom, I'm telling you, I believe that the phantom that Hamilton spoke of in 81 was a ploy because it precisely, you know, laid out this, you know, oh, well, there's, you know, they're speaking of a phantom that the Supreme Court would actually do things that would be unconstitutional when the Supreme Court is the guardians of the Constitution. In other words, in this very particular verse of 81, Article 81, Hamilton was basically defending and saying there's no way that the Supreme Court could actually violate the Constitution. They're the guardians of it.
Right.
And so the seven cases was Marbury v. Madison in 1803. Right. And I'll send these to you.
Yeah. Okay.
Fletcher v. Peck, 1810. Sturgis v. Crownshield, 1819. Dartmouth College v. Woodward, 1819. McCullough v. Maryland, 1819. Cowens v. Virginia, 1821. Now, that right there, I believe, was the case that really got these guys going, hey, we don't think, you know, with what Monroe was doing with the Missouri Compromise, they were just, men were actually becoming very aware that, you know, things were being redefined that they thought was absolutely in conflict with what they understood the Constitution and the federal government to be. And so the last one was Gibbons v. Ogden, 1824. And so if you notice, you know, the last one, two, three, four, five, the last five, you know, happened in a matter of just a few years. 1803, 1810, and then 1819. I mean, it seemed like Marshall was getting it right, but he used these cases to aggrandize his view of what the federal government should be able to do. And his rulings were correct. His opinions aggrandized and said that the federal government could do anything necessary and proper. It felt if it needed to do it, it could do it. And they used that as legal justification for when the federal government did things down the road. And it was in the late 1830s, 40s, when Madison was dying, or he was just so out of, you know, because you know, I don't know how what do you want to say? How indigent or not indigent? That's not right. He was possibly convalescent. You know, when you're in that geriatric stage, you know, yeah. you're just trying to, you know, enjoy the last few days of your life and realizing that you had a good life, that type of stuff. So I don't think, and you know, after 1834. Madison's involvement with government really went down. I think he died in 1839. And so he stopped being so adamant in speaking out. I wish he would have spoke out against Marshall. But the reason he didn't, folks, is because opinions meant nothing. The one thing that he could have done the whole Union a favor. And Jefferson, when Marshall made his opinions with Marbury v. Madison, they should have said, you know what? It's nice that you have this opinion, but we're going to strike that because what your opinions are not law. They're just your opinions. And so you can keep your opinions to themselves. They shouldn't be associated to this case. You rule these cases on law and fact. That is all. Opinions do not matter. And had they done that and severed the ability to adjoin opinions, because look at what we're doing now. We're all going back and forth on the opinions, and that's how we're bickering over cases instead of the law and the facts.
Right. Everyone's got opinion.
Right. Okay. And they all stink. So anyway, so okay, with that, yes, Marshall was a dirty bird. He was definitely a guy that did some serious damage, and so this is this point in time where Thomas Jefferson and James Madison said we cannot allow this. And you were right. This was providential. I think that this had to occur because John Adams was a God-fearing man. He was a good man, but he was a little tyrant because he was too stern. He was too stubborn. And I think he wanted to protect himself because you got to remember in his election as president, Jefferson had to be the bigger man, and he literally was the bigger man, and he had to step aside and say, you know, John Adams should be president, right? Because it was literally a tie, and had Jefferson not stepped down at that time to allow Adams to become president, but he mm-hmm. didn't think that it would go that far.
Right.
Right. And so in 1800, Adams and Madison were prepared, and they actually thwarted Adams's ability to get reelected. As a matter of fact, if I remember correctly,
Jefferson and Madison.
Yeah. I'm sorry. You know, forgive me, folks. I always misstate a lot, but you're right. Jefferson and Adams. And I think if you really look at how the counts went, I don't think Adams was that close. I think that there was another contender, and the reason that other contender, took so long. I think Aaron Burr was one of those guys, and I think Clinton was another one of those guys, because the governor of New York. What they were doing, what Madison and Jefferson was doing for the Electoral College, was they split the vote enough to where Adams seemed to be the odd man out, and it seemed that Jefferson may have actually almost lost to one of those people that they got other people to rally to support to bring John Adams's support down. Does that make sense?
That sounds kind of weird, GR.
So it's like how the parties today play with the primaries. They put a couple of, you know, people to split the vote, you know, how the Democrats will put Democrats in a Republican primary to kind of split the vote. You know, one person that's socially conservative, but, you know, maybe not fiscally conservative, to run against somebody that's really a strong conservative to kind of split that vote.
Right.
And so
happens all the time, GR.
Yes, and that's exactly what Jefferson and Madison did, so that Adams was, it was almost a guarantee that Adams wasn't going to get reelected. But it was very close, where almost Jefferson didn't get elected. It took, I believe, 60 votes, I believe, somewhere in there. It was a really astronomical amount of time that it required. Okay, you guys got to vote again, and you got to vote again, because they had to get a clear winner. And mm-hmm. in this particular case, that's why the 12th Amendment was written, was because of that election.
Wow.
So anyway, we're on paragraph 21, and so go ahead.
Okay. 21. But the resolution has done more than guard against misconstruction by expressly referring to cases of a deliberate, palpable, and dangerous nature. It specifies the object of the interposition, which it contemplates to be solely that of arresting the progress of the evil of usurpation and of maintaining the authorities, rights, and liberties appertaining to the states as parties to the Constitution.
Okay, so go keep going into the next one now.
All right, front 22.
Because this is where he really starts drilling into some details at the very end of 22. Keep going.
Okay. From this view of the resolution, it would seem inconceivable that it can incur any just disapprobation from those who, laying aside all momentary impressions and recollecting the genuine source and object of the federal Constitution, shall candidly and accurately interpret the meaning of the General Assembly. If the deliberate exercise of dangerous powers palpably withheld by the Constitution could not justify the parties to it in interposing even so far as to arrest the progress of the evil and thereby to preserve the Constitution itself as well as to provide for the safety of the parties to it, there would be an end to all relief from usurped power and a direct subversion of the rights specified or recognized under all the state constitutions, as well as a plain denial of the fundamental principle on which our independence itself was declared.
Okay, so this is where people step up and go, hey, GR, isn't it already too late? Isn't it too late because they, you know, they've got, this is where people succumb to the sovereign citizen movement. And I tell people it's never too late until the final line is when the states themselves surrender their sovereignty over the Constitution. They have to formally do this.
Okay.
In other words, they have to willingly let the federal government put aside the Constitution, it's going to happen soon. The federal government's going to say, hey, what we have to do is not going, and they're not going to actually say it this way. They're basically going to say, we've got such a financial problem that we're going to have to go down this path that is, you know, this unique path as the solution for, you know, saving America.
Mm-hmm.
And if the states at that point do not stand up and say, no, you cannot put aside the Constitution and go down that path, we're going to be confronted with this. I don't think it's going to be, I believe that, you know, the adversary, the, you know, Satan or what have you, is going to make this kind of seem like, you know, well, it's not that dramatic, is it? I mean, they're not really putting aside the Constitution permanently. It's just for this little while. It's kind of like what Wilson did with the 16th Amendment. Remember, Wilson said, we're just going to pass this amendment so that we can buy our way into prosperity so that once we do, we can, you know, just cancel the amendment.
Right. Wrong.
Then put that in the amendment itself or put a sunset. Say, okay, we'll give you 4 years. And that at this point in time, we'll revisit it, and, you know, but make it expire. The bottom line, folks, this is what's going to happen. This is where they're going to actually go down that path and, you know, create this destruction of the Union itself and force us, or actually just take our hand and guide us right into this new form of governing. Okay, so with the next paragraph. Go ahead.
Okay. This is 23. But it is objected that the judicial authority is to be regarded as the sole expositor of the Constitution in the last resort. And it may be asked for what reason the declaration by the General Assembly, supposing it to be theoretically true, could be required at the present day and in so solemn a manner.
And what he just said was that these other states objected to the states actually standing up to be the ultimate tribunal. Where they were saying, no, the judicial authority is regarded as our final arbiter or the sole expositor. That was sole expositor. In other words, nobody else. And this is why Madison up above said that only the parties could be that tribunal. Now he's going to explain in paragraphs 24, 25, and 26 how the courts cannot be that sole expositor.
Great. I've been looking forward to this.
Here you go.
Okay. 24. On this objection, it might be observed, first, that there may be instances of usurped power which the forms of the Constitution would never draw within the control of the judicial department. Secondly, that if the decision of the judiciary be raised above the authority of the sovereign parties to the Constitution, the decisions of the other departments not carried by the forms of the Constitution before the judiciary must be equally authoritative and final with the decisions of that department.
Now hold on here. So he's basically saying, on this objection, it might be observed first that this, you know, is a reason for why we do this. And then if you notice the language of what he starts off with, the rest of this paragraph, but the proper answer to the objection is. I just wanted to point this out so that as you read that, now he's really answering the question. Why not the court? Go ahead.
But the proper answer to the objection is that the resolution of the General Assembly relates to those great and extraordinary cases in which all the forms of the Constitution may prove ineffectual against infractions dangerous to the essential rights of the parties to it. The resolution supposes that dangerous powers not delegated may not only be usurped and executed by the other departments, but that the judicial department also may exercise or sanction dangerous powers beyond the grant of the Constitution, and consequently that the ultimate right of the parties to the Constitution to judge whether the compact has been dangerously violated must extend to violations by one delegated authority as well as by another, by the judiciary as well as by the legislative or the legislature.
So do you see
as well as by the executive or the legislature.
Okay. So does that make sense? So he's basically saying that, you know, when it comes down to really dangerous powers with the, you know, where they're being executed by another department, but that the judicial department may also exercise or sanctions of dangerous powers. So in other words, he basically is saying that Congress could come down and do something that is outside the boundaries of the Constitution, and the judicial department might actually agree with it and support it, and or the president. That if the usurpation can come from one department, it can come from all of them.
Right.
And they can all work together. See, going back to Federalist Paper 49, you got to look at the title. It's Methods of Dealing with Encroachments by One Department Over Another. So in other words, when we looked at the process of Federalist Paper 49, right? I don't know if you have that up again.
I can have it in seconds. So just give
Oh, okay. So looking at Federalist Paper 49, this is where James Madison actually, you know, points out that, you know, these are dealing with infractions of one branch over another. I mean, that's exactly how the title goes.
Yeah, I've got it up.
So do I.
Any particular place you want me to go?
Yeah, so no. I'm just going to read the title. method of guarding against the encroachments of any one department of government by appealing to the people through a convention. So in other words, he's talking
that word.
Right. So he's talking about one very specific thing that's happening here. Right. He's talking about the judiciary violating the Congress, you know, and usurping power of Congress. In other words, what he's really talking about is the separations of power. Right.
Right.
Method of guarding against the encroachments of any one department of the government by appealing to. So when he's saying this, and actually when you go through reading this, I don't want to read it again, but the point is that he's literally talking about one branch, like the judiciary or the executive, overreaching over the legislature. And the reason why is because why the legislature? Now, the legislature is usually the least popular branch of government. Why? Because they're the ones that make the laws.
Sure.
Now, when we see the overreach, typically the overreach would be by either by the judiciary or the executive to seize the ability to make law.
Mm.
So when we look at, you know, this, you know, breaking through the boundaries of the Constitution, we literally see how the I'll call it the Holy Grail is the authority of law, creating law.
Okay.
And that's why we constantly look at, you know, the Congress as, you know, the sovereign, the power, because they have the power to make or, you know, take away law. So we don't have time to get into the next one. However true, as he carries on and goes through this. So
I want you to know that there's that word again, convention.
Oh, yeah.
In Federalist 49.
Yes.
Okay? Mm-hmm. And I'm, you know, whenever it shows up, it's almost like a trigger word that's used by the convention states people.
The convention of state people as well as the anti-conventionites. Correct. Right. I mean, so most people, as a matter of fact, up above, I will even bring it in here. When we read this in 18, even in the case of ordinary conventions between different nations, he's not talking about, you know, he's talking about a process in, you know, between nations. He's definitely not talking specifically about an Article 5 convention.
Right.
So we're talking about a process of people working out, you know, a solution and how to do that for a treaty, for or the process of doing something or something that is accepted. So it becomes accepted law. It becomes an accepted standard. Folks, this may seem like it's eye glazing stuff, but this is so powerful in understanding the limitations of our general government. Now, in our next show, Paul and I are going to go through Thanksgiving. So you want to tune in tomorrow for that. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic. We need your help. God bless.
Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Mobiusstrip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Mobiusstrip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.